So when I was growing up, one of the things mom and dad did, part of being homeschooled, was you had a lot of flexibility. One of the things mom and dad did when I was starting at like 12 was they started dropping me off at the Saline County Library like all day long, which I loved. I mean, I love to read to this day. I love to read. The problem was when you're like 11 and 12, you don't know that all the books in the library are not children's books. So I started reading everything. I started reading a lot. I read by the age of like 13, I had read every book that Stephen King had written, which is a problem because it definitely expanded my vocabulary. And when I don't have a lot of friends who aren't homeschooled, I don't hang out with a lot of people who can tell me, hey, that word's not good. So there were times when I would slip my expanded vocabulary into daily conversations that got quite the jolt. Like one time I'm having dinner with my family and I say a word. I didn't know if it was, you know, I didn't know what kind of word it was, but in the context that I had read it in the book, I said it like that, and apparently it was a bad word because the conversation just, and my family was like, where did you hear that word at? And then I realized if I told them, they would stop dropping me off at the library. So my little homeschool brain's thinking quick, and I go, I made it up. Look, Niedelhofer, Dummelfar. I'm doing it even now. I'm just making up these words. And eventually I came back to mom and dad, and I said, hey, why don't you tell me all the four-letter words so that I can, you know, avoid that kind of thing in the future? And they're like, Jonathan, you're married now. You're going to have to figure out. Today I want to talk about one of the four-letter words that we talk about the least. And that's in large part because we think we have it dealt with. The word is evil. And evil, we tend to think we have progressed past. It's, you know, we can admit there's evil in places, other places in the world maybe, but we like to relegate it out there until it slaps us in the face. Like with the 9/11 or some tsunami or a death or cancer or divorce, we're reminded that evil is very real in the world. Now, here's why this matters for churches to talk about. Because for a long time, the world has had different philosophies to deal with evil, and none of them work. But one of them, and the one that a lot of you are familiar with, even if you don't ever hear it called this, is modernism. Churches of Christ are a very modernistic tribe. We grew up in the age of progress. You know, think Jetsons, and, you know, we finally will arrive one day, and we'll have, basically, we'll invent evil away. We will organize the world in a way that evil is no longer a problem. This is a very real philosophy that has fallen on some real hard times in the last few decades, starting probably with 9/11. But for a long time, we thought we would just basically progress out away from evil. Now look, I'm from this state. I have eaten squirrel and I have used an outhouse. I am all for progress, but you can't invent evil away. It just doesn't work that way. Or, and this is one of the things that you see, just a very divisive spirit in our cultural age right now, is we think that we can vote evil away. For a couple of decades, we've thought if we could just get our right person in office, if we could just get our right, and what happens is there is a sense of hope when it's your person and despair when it's not, and very little change actually happens no matter who it is. Because we think we're going to vote evil away. But evil doesn't work like that. Politics, no matter how much they claim to be, and man, you know they claim to be this, politics is never the solution to evil. I love America, but America is part of the problem.
After the end, after the Cold War kind of collapsed and USSR was collapsing, one of the Marxist leaders said, one of the things that they said was, we failed to realize the line of good and evil runs through everybody. That's the problem. Evil's not just out there. It's not just in other people. It's not just in other nations. It's not just they that are broken, it's all of us. And so we find out one of the themes in the Bible is the problem of evil. If I was to describe the mission of God to you today, it would be God is dealing with evil. And I want you to know, as I talk about this today, I'm not talking about evil abstractly, right? I mean, I've seen too many affairs. I've seen too many families crumble apart. I've had a lot of my friends get hooked on methamphetamines. Some of them die. Evil is incredibly personal. But for me, this really started 15 years ago, right after the tsunami hit Sri Lanka, and a team of Christians went to tsunami, to the worst hit part of the tsunami in Sri Lanka. And Leslie and I were digging through all this rubble, trying to help this little village rebuild. And at one point, we come across some children's shoes. And then you just get punched in the face by evil. This is what evil looks like. One of the things about evil is it's not just a personal problem. It's a cosmological problem. It's all of creation is groaning. And it's not just the world that's broken. It's not just tsunamis and earthquakes and volcanoes and tornadoes. It's I am too. You can't just focus on personal evil, and you can't just focus on creation groaning. When every month we hear another natural tragedy or a social crisis or a school shooting or whatever it is, we're reminded evil is still a four-letter word. Christians have to talk about it. We see this problem most clearly in the story in the Old Testament in a book named Job. Job is a very wealthy, very lucky, happy man. And then the chapter 1 of Job hits. It's the worst chapter in the Hebrew Scriptures. Because in chapter 1, this guy loses his property. He loses his family. His kids all die. His property's destroyed. His camels are stolen. And everybody knows how much it stinks when your camels are stolen. This guy's having a bad day. But unknowns to Job, the reader of the book of Job knows what's happening. The Satan, or the accuser, goes up to God in chapter 1 and says, when God is bragging on Job, Satan says, yeah, but the real reason that he's so good is because you protected him so much. You've given him so much. Take all that away and he'll curse you. But Job doesn't know that. All he knows is he's having some epic bad day. For Job, his problem seems like bad weather and bad men robbing and killing people. But more than that, he starts to think God might be behind it. Look at what it actually says in Job 1. One of his servants comes up and says, the fire of God fell from the heavens and burned up the sheep and the serpents, or the servants. The fire of God. But we know better. Because the curtain has been pulled back for us. We have a bigger view of what's going on here. That's actually a very scriptural view of evil. The people who are going through it don't know exactly what God is up to. But sometimes God pulls back the curtain and lets us see glimpses into it. This is why Paul says, listen, your battle is not against what? Flesh and blood. Because we forget that. Whenever you hate a person, you have forgotten that. Your battle is not against flesh and blood, but against the principalities and powers. But Job doesn't know that. And Job spends the next 30 chapters asking God basically something like why. And when God finally shows up, God doesn't even answer his question. The mere presence of God is enough to reassure him. And what I love about that is that this is a microcosm of the Bible and the way it talks about evil. It talks about evil, but it doesn't ever try to explain it. It doesn't try to explain why the serpent was in the Garden of Eden. It doesn't explain why God put the tree, that the forbidden fruit that Adam and Eve unleashed evil in the world in. It just lets us know how God is responding to it. So right after the Garden of Eden, right after sin and death enters the world, the next major story in the book of Genesis is the flood. The flood, we think, is a children's Bible story because it's in our children's Bibles. But it's a very disturbing story if you're paying attention. Basically, God is rebooting the earth. He is destroying most of the life in the world. We think it's a children's book because there's a rainbow and a floating zoo. But it's a real disturbing story. Why does God do this? Part of the answer is in Genesis chapter 6. It says, if you could put that up, the Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. And so the Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart, I love this, was deeply troubled. All religions in the ancient world had a flood story, but this is one that sets apart because this is one of a God whose heart is broken. His heart is broken because, by the way, he knows what we do not know about evil. When we are evil to one another, it has deep impacts, not just on the person you're evil to and not just on you, but on other people around you. See, since the fall, what God said would happen, that death would enter the world, did. So Cain rises up and kills his brother. Lamech invents a code of revenge that escalates things dramatically. This guy named Tubal-Cain starts creating weapons. And in chapter 5, Genesis 5, the refrain of every life is, and they died, and they died, and they died. It's like in the rest of Genesis, you see the lie of the serpent revealed. When the serpent lets sin enter the world, he says, will you really die? And the rest of Genesis is answering a resounding yes. What you see in Genesis 6 in the flood story is the untamed justice of God, because he knows how ugly evil is. The problem you have with the flood, it is the universal application of justice. When you hear people say, I just want what I deserve, the flood story should make us pump the brakes on that. Nobody wants what they deserve. Long before Paul preached, there's no one righteous, you see it in the flood story. Even Noah, who's declared righteous by God, it's a qualified righteous. He's the only one righteous in his age. At least he's better than the other people. But God does this because he knows the ugliness of evil. In Exodus, it says that the sin of the parents carries on to different generations. I probably don't need to unpack that for you. Some of you are here today and you are dealing with sins that you never really did, but that your grandparents did. The far-reaching implications of the way we live our lives. God knows the pain that comes with divorce and abuse and murder. That when I sin, it does not just affect me or those around me. It affects my descendants. So the question isn't, why is God justified in sending the flood? The question, honestly, if we were self-aware, is why doesn't God do this more often? Because it's not like we're better than people in Noah's day. It's that God has changed fundamentally the way he deals with evil. You remember the sign that God gives at the end of the flood? He sets something in the sky. What is it? Rainbow. Actually, it says a bow, but it is the rainbow. You know, the bow is the ancient symbol for power. And in that moment, God is saying, I'm not going to deal with evil this way anymore. I'm not going to deal with evil by wiping out all of life. I've changed the way I'm going to deal with it. And that leads us to Genesis chapter 12, which any sermon on the mission of God has to go through Genesis 12. Because now that God is going to deal with evil differently, here's how he's going to do it. He goes to this guy named Abram. And he says, I want you to leave your country, your people, your father's household, and go to a land that I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all people on earth will be blessed because of you. When God is going to do something about evil now that he's not going to flood the world, now that he's not going to get rid of everybody who's got evil in them, he says, I'm going to choose a family, I'm going to make them into a great nation, and they're going to be a blessing. And God keeps his part of the promise, right? But the problem was, they were called to be a solution to the problem of evil, but they wound up being a part of the problem over and over again. For example, eventually these people are going to become the Israelites. God's going to deliver them from slavery. He's going to meet them on Mount Sinai, give them the Ten Commandments, tell them a way to live differently as a way of blessing the world around them. And rule number one is, don't worship other gods. And while Moses, their great leader, is on the mountain getting these commandments, They are down on the ground breaking rule number one. They are worshiping a calf. Calf in the ancient world was a symbol of power. Because I don't know about you, when I think cow, I think power. That was what they were doing. They were worshiping one aspect of God and reducing God to that. They create an idol. They break the rule, the first rule that they're given. And the reason this is important is because Israel's problem is our problem. We try to be the solution to the problem of evil, and we discover we're a part of the problem just like them. And look at what God says about them in Exodus chapter 32. The Lord said, go down because your people, he's telling Moses on the mountain, go down because your people who you brought up out of Egypt have become corrupt. Those are the very words he uses about the human race in Genesis 6, talking about before the flood. These people are supposed to be the cure, but they're part of, they came down with the same disease. Israel was called to be God's solution to evil in the world, but they were also a part of the problem. By the way, this story is known by the rabbis as the temptation of Israel. A temptation that is very clear to see they failed. So they stumble around in the wilderness for 40 years. And that brings us finally to the Gospel of Luke and the series that we're in, that we're going to close out this first half of today. A little bit of recap. Do you remember what happens at the beginning of Jesus' ministry? Before he does any kind of ministry, Jesus gets baptized. To you, that sounds like a very Christian thing, but remember, Jews had been baptizing for years. If you wanted to be a Jew, you would go through the waters of Exodus, just like the Israelite people. That was what it was. And Jesus, in this moment, much like he does with communion and the Passover, is subverting that whole thing. This is why when you get baptized, don't forget, Jesus is in those waters. Jesus takes on your life. You take on Jesus' life. The life you could not live, he has lived for us. That you meet Jesus in baptism. This was a huge deal. And right after the baptism, Luke has this kind of genealogy in Luke chapter 3, verse 23. It says, Jesus was about 30 years old when he began his ministry. He was the son, so it was thought, of Joseph. And then he shoots off 77 names, seven, the perfect number, 77, number of creation. And then after the, at the end of those 77 names, of numbers, names like Abraham and David, he gets to this a few verses later. The son of Enosh, the son of Seth, the son of Adam, who was the son of God. That's your genealogy. If you're baptized, that's your genealogy. Luke is trying to tell you, we go back to Adam and Eve, who are the children of God, including Jesus. Jesus is baptized with all the other people, but he's not like one of us. And this is why this is really important to get before we get to our main text today, which is going to rock. Because Jesus doesn't do any ministry until he is baptized. He does not minister in his life for the blessing of God. Some of us do that. Some of us think God is going to love us a little bit more if we baptize a few more people, which is great. That's great work. That's stuff that God really cares about. God's not going to love you anymore. Some of us think we're going to be loved more by God if we serve other Christians better. That's great. That's what we're called to do. God's not going to love you anymore. Jesus ministers out of the blessing, not for the blessing. And here's what happens next. As soon as he's baptized, Luke chapter 4, verse 1. Jesus, full of the Holy Spirit, left the Jordan and was led by the Spirit into the wilderness, where for 40 days he was tempted by the devil, and he ate nothing during those days, and at the end of them he was hungry. All the lights on your Bible dashboard should be blinking now. Jesus goes through the very waters that were parted for the Israelites to come through, and then he goes out into the wilderness for a number of 40. So he's plugging into the story of Israel. And he is tempted by the devil. But where Israel failed, he succeeds. And the reason that Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all three of those stories of Jesus, the Gospels, all three of them start Jesus' ministry doing these things is because he has bound up the strong man. He has defeated the devil. He has succeeded where we failed. And everything he does in his ministry is a byproduct of that. Every funeral he goes to, of course, the dead have no choice but to listen. He has defeated the devil. Everywhere he goes, he sets the world right. He defeats evil. Everywhere he goes, he heals because disease has no claim on him. He has defeated evil in his own life, and his ministry is a byproduct of that. He was doing what Israel was called to do, but found herself unable to do. He is the faithful human. He is the new Adam. He is the one that we could not be, but we can join in him and in his life. And what's crazy is that later on in his ministry, Jesus starts getting regular, ordinary people, people like me and you, and giving them this kind of authority to do what he does. Even though they haven't defeated evil, he has. He's able to share his authority. And that brings us finally to our text for today in Luke chapter 10. Because on a mission Sunday, I think it's highly appropriate, we close out this part of the Gospel of Luke by pointing out to you this short-term mission trip where Jesus takes 72 disciples and he sends them out, and they come back and they're like, "Lord, even the demons submit to us in your name." And Jesus responds with something that I think is amazing. He said that 72 returned with joy, "Lord, even the demons submit to us in your name." And he replied, "I saw Satan fall like lightning. I've given you authority to trample on snakes and scorpions." What was the original enemy in the Garden of Eden? "I've given you authority to trample on them, to overcome all the powers of the enemy. Nothing will harm you. However, do not rejoice that the spirits submit to you, but rejoice that your names are written in heaven." He says, they're doing this ministry, and he says, "I see Satan fall like lightning. I give you the power to stomp on snakes, to overcome the power of the enemy." The disciples, think about what they've been doing. They've been walking on hot sand. They've been, you know, going around praying with people, talking with people, announcing the kingdom of God. Their actions took place in the visible world, in a world where you could touch and smell and see. But Jesus sees differently. Jesus sees that their actions are having consequences in a world that they could not see. Because what you do when you join in the mission of God has both personal and cosmological implications. They think they're just doing ministry. Jesus looks past that and says, "You have waged war. You are taking on the devil himself." And by the power of God, they were winning. The beauty of the incarnation, if we take the Bible seriously, if we take the mission of God and the scriptures seriously, is that it didn't just happen in Jesus' church. It happens here. As in right now, we are, as Paul says, the body of Christ. And what we do has both personal and cosmological implications. The Bible doesn't say a lot about why evil is in the world, but it does say a lot about what God is trying to do about it. Namely, us, the church. We are the heirs of Abraham. If I was the devil, I get how much the threat the church poses to me. So you know what I would do if I was the devil? I would try to get Christians to think what it meant to be the church was reduced to being in a building for 1 hour on a Sunday morning. I would try and make us think that the main thing was being right on particular doctrines, and then I would try to make us as mean and hateful to everyone who disagreed with us. If I was the devil, I would try to make the church forget who she is and the calling she has. I would try to get the church to turn a blind eye to the suffering and evil in the world around me, because if the church ever figures out who she is, the devil doesn't stand a chance. Because the move, the counter move in the scriptures for evil is you. More correctly, it's us. The hope of the world isn't a certain philosophy or a certain political party. It's the church, and nothing else even comes close. So a few years ago, I heard this story about a guy named Brandon Moody who was going to one of those giant passion plays around Easter time. It was a church that had like thousands of people, and the guy who was playing Jesus at the very end, they had him ascend. And so a couple of guys were on a rope and pulley backstage, and they were pulling him up, and they got almost to the top of this giant roof, and then their hand slipped. And Jesus, a great ascension starts becoming the second coming real quick. Just, you know, he's coming back down, and they grab the rope right before he hits the ground, and the Jesus has a lot of poise, and he goes, "One more thing." Love each other. If Jesus could say a fresh word to his church today, I think that would be it. In my first year here, I'll tell you, I've been so impressed with the way we do that. I've heard stories after stories of moments like the Striplings or the Shields or the McClanahans and the way this church just showed up and loved. And dozens, maybe hundreds of more stories beside that. Because when the church is on, when we're loving, it makes a difference. The world is watching. I was talking with Jeremy and Martha Smith this week, and they were telling me some of the great stuff that's happening in Mozambique. One thing that's happening, I know today with ISIS and all the news, it's easy to be afraid of people who are Muslim, but these are our missionaries working in a Muslim country. One of the things they told me was about Antonio, this Muslim preacher. He was an imam, and Antonio was going around preaching in Arabic, but he didn't speak Arabic. He didn't understand it, but that was the language of Islam, and so he kind of memorized it, and he was able to preach it. But they came in and taught him the gospel in Makua. And they asked him, "Do you really believe what you are saying?" Because he didn't speak that language. And when they told him the story of Jesus, he decided he wanted to be a part of that. And now he goes all over Mozambique telling stories and saying, "Let me tell you about the God who speaks your language." So many years ago, Bad Brad, one of my good friends that a lot of y'all know now, was working in a children's home in Fort Worth along with my wife. And they told me about this little boy, 4 years old. By the time he was 4, he had been abused in ways that no little boy should ever be abused. So much so that he could not go to sleep without heavy narcotics at night. They discovered that they could avoid the drugs if they would read him bedtime stories until he fell asleep. So they would spend hours reading this little boy bedtime stories so that he could go to sleep without heavy narcotics. I have this friend named John Jones who was grandfathered into a Red Cross thing with Burmese refugee people. And John Jones, even though he was well up in his age, was in his late 70s, kept flying over to these very harsh conditions to get food for these Burmese refugees. He once told me he could not see an American dollar bill without thinking about how much rice it could buy for them. I don't know if you're like me, but when you see the stories that are happening on the news, or when you hear stories like that, like who would abuse a 4-year-old? Or why would God allow Burmese refugees to just be starving in their camps? If you got any kind of heart at all, you think, "God, where are you?" I'll tell you where God is. God is reading to that little boy so he can go to sleep without narcotics at night. I'll tell you where God is. God is running all around a Burmese refugee camp trying to get rice for those people. And I see Satan fall like lightning. Yeah. Evil is still a 4-letter word. But so, thank God, is love. I'd like to invite our shepherds to take their places in the aisles. And I would like to invite you, if you feel like God is calling you to something in your life, join in this mission in your neighborhood, maybe you'd like prayers for courage, prayers for God to use you in your office, wherever it is, or maybe you got something going on in your life and you'd like them to just bless you with, these godly guys would love to pray for you. If you want to be baptized and meet Jesus in baptism today, I'll be right down here. I would love to receive you if you'll come forward while together we stand and worship.